are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, February 10th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayan. On to Iowa, New Hampshire, and the bullshit economy. Also on the program today, Trump fires witnesses in his impeachment. Schumer demands an IG report in response. New Hampshire down to the wire as Buttigieg makes a final play for the billionaire support. Trump's budget, pure Republican, with cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and a little bump to the military. The Democratic House passes the Protecting Right to Organize Act. PRO Act! It'll die in the Senate, or in fact, never even see the light of day there. Meanwhile, Trump administration seeks to suspend humanitarian assistance to Yemen. That's right, folks. Rudy Giuliani now has a formal pipeline to task the Department of Justice to investigate Trump's opponents. Meanwhile, the Oscars happened last night, but I fell asleep. All this, oh, and lastly, four members of the Chinese military indicted for that huge Equifax breach. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We are in skeletal crew mode again. Here we go.
True believer mode.
True believer mode. That's right. Brendan is here. We got Dorsey on the on computer number two, and I will be holding down the fort solo today. A little bit of house cleaning. We will be doing live coverage tomorrow night of the New Hampshire primary. What is that buzz? What? Oh, that's weird. All right, keep it up just a little bit, I guess. Oh, there it goes. It went away. We will be doing live coverage of the New Hampshire results as they come in tomorrow night. We will be here tomorrow. Dave Weigel will be hopefully on the program to give a sense of what's happening in New Hampshire. Feels a little bit like there's a Klobuchar surge. And, yeah, put that down just again. I hear it again. There's a bit of a Klobuchar surge. Now, I would be remiss if I did not remind you what John from San Antonio has been telling us all along is the most important factor structurally about the primaries this time around. And that is you need a 15% threshold in the primary state to be awarded delegates. And if you are someone who is excited to have a progressive, like I say, I don't think most voters see lanes in the way that we see lanes around here, or if you listen to this program. In other words, I don't think they see ideological lanes in the same way. Everybody who's interested in politics talks about the progressives or the left or whatever it is and the moderates. I don't know if most voters, in fact, I'm quite convinced that most voters don't see those lanes. Maybe 35%, 40% of the primary goers do. But the rest, I think, just they have their own lanes that they create. But if you are one of those people who are looking for the progressives to win in this primary, the rise of Klobuchar is heartening. Because between Joe Biden's faltering, and he is faltering, I think he's going to make it to Super Tuesday, but it wouldn't surprise me now if, and even a month ago, I wouldn't have said this. It would not shock me. I still doubt it, but it would not shock me if he drops out before Super Tuesday, where he's encouraged to do so. But what's really happening is Michael Bloomberg has been leading a sort of a rear assault, as it were, on Joe Biden, taking away a lot of his endorsements, taking away a lot of his money sources. Bloomberg doesn't need any money. He just meets with the donors and says, don't give any money. And that is an offer that many of them can't refuse, it seems like. So with Pete Buttigieg having what I think would be a temporary surge, and Amy Klobuchar having a moderate surge, as it were, and Bloomberg having his surge in terms of eating up a little bit of the cash that could be available, there will be no coalescing around a moderate. That's what I suspect and what I'm seeing now. I mean, it may change, but you could very well have three or four candidates in New Hampshire all landing somewhere between 13 and 19 points, percentage points of the vote. And if they are under 15, if four of them get 13, only one gets above 15%. That person gets all, I think, of the delegates. Now, I think that's unlikely. I think Pete Buttigieg is going to get, you know, above the 15% threshold as well, will Bernie. But the question is, will the other three, will Warren, will Klobuchar, will Biden? And if they don't, you're going to see the delegates split between Buttigieg and Bernie. So Friday night, we did not have live coverage of the debate. The plan was for me to go up to New Hampshire. MSNBC had asked me to go up there. And I thought I was going to get up there in time to start to live stream the debate. And at the very least, just sort of like YouTube along with it. But I got stuck on the tarmac because of gale force winds in New York. And I rolled up there just as the debate was starting. And basically watched the debate and then watched for about an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes while everybody else got on stage to talk about the debate. And then I ended up going on for about 10 minutes. And that was a little bit annoying. But I did have the opportunity to be in the room when Chris Matthews said what he's about to say and to look at the expression on everyone's face around me, like cameraman, guests, you know, the audience, and everybody was, there was a look of both sort of shock and surprise and concern. Here is Chris Matthews, and I will say this about Matthews, you know, like, you know, a lot of times you think like there's a people who want to protect themselves or certain classes of people from having to experience increased taxes will project onto the electorate a concern that is probably not there, right? I mean, I've been saying this, like, you know, they can talk about the Sandinistas all they want, and that's just not going to move people. If you are my age or younger, and I did meet someone the other day from Long Island who was a year older than me and did experience, you know, having to go underneath the desks as a very, you know, like in first grade or maybe in kindergarten because of a potential nuclear war. But he never did after that. So, like, you know, the cutoff is somewhere like around 54, 55, 53. Your sort of experience of the Red Menace is really zero. I mean, you knew about the Soviet Union and But Ronald Reagan came in and talked about the evil empire and made it all so cartoonish. And then by 93, the wall falls. And I will tell you this, for an 18-year-old today, the wall falling was further in the past than when I was 18 years old to World War II. And so for a lot of these people who say this stuff about, like, you know, I don't know about his communist, you know, Bernie Sanders, and exaggerate that, I always think that's a surrogate. Apparently, Chris Matthews, and, you know, seems to be sincere in his concern here. But it's, I think it's a little bit much.
I have my own views of the word socialist, and I'll be glad to tell them, share them with you in private. And they go back to the early 1950s. I have an attitude about them. I remember the Cold War. I have an attitude towards Castro. I believe if Castro and the Reds had won the Cold War, there would have been executions in Central Park, and I might have been one of the ones getting executed. And certain other people would be there cheering, okay? So I have a problem with people who took the other side. I don't know who Bernie supports over these years. I don't know what he means by socialist. 1 week, it's Denmark. We're going to be like Denmark. Okay, that's harmless. That's basically a capitalist country with a lot of good social welfare programs. Denmark is harmless.
It's pretty clearly in the Denmark category, yeah.
Are you sure? How do you know? Did he tell you that?
Well, I mean, that's what he says, and that's what his agenda calls for, right?
Yeah.
He's not calling for any...
Let's figure that one out.
Well, we haven't seen a campaign yet where video of him praising the other version,
right,
of Castro,
and
has been used.
Well, but that
will be used.
That's a question
we
of
seen how that plays
of how tender, what the effect that has.
Well, what does he think of Castro? That's a great question. What did you think of Fidelismo? We all thought he was great when he first. I thought he was cheering like mad for him when he first went in. And then he became a communist and started shooting every one of his enemies.
Okay, hold
so,
all those thoughts on the Cuban. Hold those thoughts on Cuban Revolution. I have to go back to the spin room and Democratic presidential candidate.
Okay, so. If I understand this now, despite the fact that Chris Matthews was excited about Fidel early on when people, this is before that he realized that he was going to have a problem with the United States and they didn't want him to nationalize, you know, and actually allow the Cubans to enjoy any of their natural resources. Chris Matthews' concern about Bernie Sanders seems to be that I don't know if there's any other way to read what he said, that there is at least a greater than 0% chance that Sanders gets elected and then there are extrajudicial killings that will take place. Not maybe not. They wouldn't be necessarily in Central Park, but they could be. Maybe in the, you know, like every town commons will have like a couple of people who are the biggest capitalists. And I mean, that is nuts. The idea that the people around Bernie Sanders or Bernie Sanders himself or anybody associated with the campaign or anybody associated with Sanders perceives a notion that involves executions or even just like jailings or even like ticketing. You've been too much of a capitalist. You're going to get like one of these stickers or something like this. That is just nuts. And I can't, he seems to be sincere in his concern. Because it was one of those, like, I'll tell you in person what, you know, privately what my things are. And then he goes on to basically express what those concerns are. But it also is setting the table for people to take Trump and the Republicans' portrayal of Sanders in this way seriously. Now, with that said, as ridiculous as that sounds, that's what we're going to hear from the ads. They're going to say he loves Fidel Castro, or he loved Fidel Castro, or he loved Daniel Ortega. And 70% of the voting population, at least, is going to go, what? I mean, do I think Bernie Sanders will be hurt in Florida?
Yes.
By that? Yes. Do I think Bernie Sanders will be hurt in Florida by, talking about Juan Guaido? Yeah. And if Florida was the linchpin of the election, I would say that would have some relevance. But if Florida is not. And beyond that, I think, honestly, a huge percentage of the population is just going to be completely like, what? He praised somebody 40 years ago? And I'm supposed to make my decision on voting for this guy based on that? I guess it's possible, but if people are going to be moved by a statement, a videotape of a statement that Bernie Sanders made 40 years ago, and they're going to be able, the Republicans are going to be able to create this whole sort of narrative about how evil, communists are, et cetera, to a whole host of people who have no recollection even of pre-93 when the wall fell. Just imagine what they could do with Joe Biden, or imagine what they could do with the stories about Amy Klobuchar that are out there, the way that she treated her interns, or, you know, true or not. Imagine what they could do with Pete Buttigieg. Imagine what they could do with anybody. People are looking for, I think, you know, one thing that's clear, that the more you go through these Democratic primaries, I think part of the reason why we have seen not huge numbers in Iowa turnout is because I think there's a significant portion of the Democratic electorate that's just like, give us a nominee. I don't care. I'm going to vote against Donald Trump. It's too hard for me to choose. I don't want to get invested in it. I got too many other things to do. Give us a nominee, I'll go out and vote for him. And then I think the people who are engaged in it, I think there's a certain percentage who are doing this on ideological grounds. Obviously, I think a huge portion of Sanders voters are voting based on ideology. I think that's probably true to a lesser extent with Warren. And then I think after that, it really just comes down to people like, I think this guy can win, or I think this woman can win. But I will tell you this right now. I've been able to now mathematically recreate what my perspective has been in terms of facing Trump. Like this whole thing, can this person go toe to toe to Trump? As if like it is, you know, people make their decision, their minds up on these debates. Like when they physically, how are they going to wrestle each other? In the that doesn't happen. But I will say this: that I think, and this was clear. Basically at this time, a little bit later in 2016, which is you cannot run on your personal resume. You cannot run on what your attributes are as a person in the general election, because you are playing on Donald Trump's playing field. And he will find a way to not just mitigate and undercut that, but depress your voters based upon proving your sales pitch to them is in some way, maybe this is at the margins, in some ways a falsehood. This happened with John Kerry. He went out there. I'm going to talk about my military service. I was an award. I got a Purple Heart. I'm going up against George Bush, who basically went AWOL, and we're doing this at the backdrop of the war, and I'm going to prove my bona fides. I was a Purple Heart winner, and they swift boated him, and his campaign collapsed. If you want to figure out who's got the best chance to win, this is the mathematical formula. Determine what percentage of a candidate's message has to do with their personal attributes. When they say, I have, you know, a legit relationship to God, and, you know, we see where Trump going to the prayer breakfast and it was garbage, or I'm going to restore integrity, or I have good moral character, or I do X, or I do Y, or I understand this, or I understand that, et cetera, et cetera. Figure out, and you know, just sit down and write down one line that comes to your mind when you think about what their pitch to you is, what that candidate's pitch to you is, figure out what percentage of their pitch is made up of that one line that comes into your head. 65%, 75%, 85%. Get that number, subtract it from 100, and then compare that to the other candidates. Whoever has the bigger number that does not involve a personal pitch as to who they are and what attributes they bring, that's how you know that Donald Trump will not be able to attack them in the same way. He will not be able, or that if he does, it won't make a difference, because their value proposition to the voter is not tied up in who they are. Donald Trump can attack you if you say you have moral integrity, because everybody with enough money can be exposed to have no moral integrity or a lack of enough to depress voters who have bought into the idea that you have moral integrity. But Donald Trump does not have the ability to undercut any type of policy proposal, particularly one that is actually delivering what he sort of vaguely says he's going to give to people. He just doesn't have that skill set. Democrats always win on that terrain. So keep that in mind. We will get to David Dayen in a moment. And I'll be hitting that point probably quite a bit over the next month or two. So bear with me. Oh, folks, check this out. As you know, hiring is a challenge. There is one place where you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. ZipRecruiter. We gotta get in on this story, because here's a story of Codable co-founder Gretchen Huebner. She went through a process where she realized how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a new game artist to grow with her education tech company. Then she switched to ZipRecruiter, saw an immediate difference. You can too by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com. /majority. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. We've talked to you about this in the past. It finds them for you. By using ZipRecruiter's screening questions to filter candidates, Gretchen found it easier to focus on the best ones than find the right one. In fact, after posting her job on ZipRecruiter, Gretchen said she was honestly surprised she found qualified applicants so quickly. Hired a new game artist in less than 2 weeks. It's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post in ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. I am one of those 4. But frankly, I got more than one. I got a dozen. And then we found Brendan, the only guy who seems to show up to work around here, is ZipRecruiter jumped out and found him. I would never use another service ever. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. ZipRecruiter, you can try it now for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y, majority. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Check it out today. I don't know what it is about President's Day, but there's some huge sales that take place around this.
Honor your presidents by, you know, engaging with the economy,
I guess. Yeah. But this is a pretty big deal. Joybird, they have, we've got a store actually around the corner, but for you, it's available online. And they have over 50 fabric and leather options, 3 shades of wood, over 250 unique silhouettes. You do the math. Joybird has got a lot to choose from. You can bring your mood boards to life. You can get your whole, like every way that you've imagined your house or your apartment, your office for that matter, to look like. Doesn't matter if you're sort of a beige or a bubblegum pink type of person. Built by Joybird, designed by you. They even offer a range of kid and pet friendly upholstery options, free fabric swatch kits that are available to let you see and touch all their fabrics, help you make the best choice. Joybird's free personal design consultants can help you with basically just your inspiration. They can take it right to actually making it happen. Each piece is made with the ultimate care and precision. All Joybird handcraft pieces come with a lifetime warranty. Plus, you get a 365-day home trial. So if you don't like it, send it back. Create furniture that matches your own fearless style at joybird.com/majority25. You can see how Joybird can make your dream space a reality today. joybird.com/majority25. Go to joybird.com/majority25 and receive an exclusive offer. Why do we call it Majority 25? Because you get 25% off your first order by using the code majority25. So that's joybird.com/majority25. Use the savings code majority25. And lastly, like I say, I don't know what's going on with this time of the year, but right now you can make your apartment, your room, your house, I don't know, lighting is huge. Do not take the money that you've spent on furniture and whatnot and let it go to waste without good lighting. Lamps Plus has been helping customers love their everyday spaces for over 40 years. They got chandeliers, they got ceiling lights, they got table lamps, they got, what do you call it? What are those? They're not scones. What is that called?
Sconces.
Sconces! The light itself is like jewelry for the home, folks. Lamps Plus is the nation's largest lighting retailer with over 55,000 designs from top brands, and they have their own exclusive designs in lighting, home furnishings, and decor. 55,000! You don't have to guess what the designs will look like or wandering around the aisles of a big box store. Lamps Plus has videos with design tips, and all the photos on their site tell you which light fixtures or furniture pieces are featured. They also have a large selection of Minka lighting, which you can transform your home into wonderful living areas. Minka is known for designs that blend function and style using innovative materials. I am loving my table lamp I have with the built-in USB function because that's the type of guy I am. I like my light. I am always about functionality, but the lighting is awesome too. It's beautiful. It's a very sort of sleek, you know, minimalist design. That's what I go for. And now you can get up to 50% off of hundreds of lighting styles between February 11th, that's tomorrow, and February 23rd. February 11th to February 23rd, that's up to 50% off Lamp Plus lighting fixture sale through February 23rd. Go to Lamps Plus, LAMPSPLUS, LampsPlus.com/majority to start saving today. That's LampsPlus.com/majority. Quick break. And David Dayton.
The parking lot behind Oasis Town, down the street from the Mexican restaurant behind the AutoZone, and the place is hawking payday loans. There's a Kmart and a KFC, fitness center and an Applebee's, Wells Fargo and a Taco John's, good time bar to get your bad swerve on. In a town that's named for razor blades, all American but Chinese made, folks working hard for shrinking pay, 21st century USA. Out on 90 we might see you pass, we got coal and methane.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Sorry, folks. You know, we farmed out all of the operations of the show today to the folks who ran the Iowa caucuses. And it's Sam Cedar
on
the Majority
Report. They make a compelling pitch.
Well, we got this new company, Shadow.
They could streamline your show.
There you go.
They said they could disrupt it.
Well, disrupting it, the guy who's going to come in and disrupt it right now, David Dayan, is the executive editor. Is it the executive editor or publisher of?
Executive editor. You know, you used to time the show with a clock.
Right.
But what you really needed was an app that explains to you when you should keep the show moving.
Right. Now what we do, I don't even know what time it is. The app just keeps the time and then says time for the phone call or time for the, and it's not right. Working out well. David Dayan, the executive editor of American Prospect, here to talk about, let's start with Iowa and the bullshit economy, which, I mean, you know, I was making a similar point. Like, this is a dynamic you can see across businesses. And what brought us Iowa was the same sort of like, you know, twilight of elites on some level. But it is infected our economy. Just give us your pitch on mm-hmm. that and see if it's disruptive.
Let's find out. So I guess where I see the connections between how this app situation unfolded and what we see in the rest of the economy is that, you know, confidence and marketing has taken precedence over quality and success in many ways. Whether you're talking about the sort of marketing to investors that, hey, we are going to take over the ride-hailing taxi industry, and we've never made money on this before, but I'm sure if you just stick with us, we will capture enough market share to do so. Or if it's marketing to customers, hey, you can see as many movies as you want for $10 a month. And this is never going to stop. There's no way that this can go wrong, even though it's way below cost and a huge savings for you. That has become a more dominant feature of our modern economy. And in this case, you have the marketing strategy of telling people they need something they don't actually need. Somehow the Iowa caucuses managed to tabulate results for 40 plus years, predating the existence of apps. Yet it was incredibly important that they get one that would be tested and coded within a matter of weeks. And the caucus organizers weren't trained on it. They had actually very little ability to even acquire the app because it was so late in getting to the App Store, or the Google Play Store, that it didn't pass their approvals. So you have this triumph of con artistry over productivity and quality, and then you have it in the political realm tied up to the fact that these were movers and shakers. These were big people within the Democratic Party blob, the group of operatives and consultants, and to say no to them would be simply inconceivable. And so there's this aspect of the Democratic grift put on top of how this sort of recapitulates what we see in the broader economy.
Let's just stay on the broader economy for a moment, and then we'll go down to that, because I think that this notion of the grift that is going on, because in all these scenarios, somebody. And usually it's at least a group of somebodies are walking away making a ton of cash, regardless of its failure. And, you know, and as you were talking about, I was thinking about Bill Lozonik, who is that professor from UMass Business, who I've had on a couple of times over the years to talk about, the stock buybacks and just sort of the the relationship between capital gains taxes and stocks, and basically the C-suites and the board of directors getting paid in stocks, and it's basically creating for them a and we see this in the context of like leverage buyouts too. There's like a there's always this sort of side bet. Like, we don't have to really invest in the success of the what is the sort of, I guess, public-facing product as much as we do in enriching ourselves getting there. And what ends up in terms of that public-facing product, it really is irrelevant in terms of us making money. Like, business is no longer about actually what you're producing. It's how much value can you can extract out of the process that makes it look like you're producing something.
And I'm glad you bring that up in the context, because you can get caught up in just, you know, thinking this is an outgrowth of just the sort of tech bro economy, right? That this is just something you see primarily in tech, but it's true really throughout. And, you know, what you brought up just there with respect to leverage buyouts and how the success or failure of the business doesn't matter as long as you can engage in financial engineering to extract your profit. The financial crisis itself was built on this bullshitting that housing prices could endlessly increase forever, and that everybody would be able to sort of work their way out of any trouble by simply refinancing. That was part of this trend as well, in my view. And so this is much broader than just, you know, tech disruptors being tech disruptors. This is about sort of an economic worldview that is, you know, not just selfish, but it relies really on con artistry. And that's, I think, the best way to describe how this went.
I mean, and to the extent that these corporations are, you know, and these companies do this, a leverage buyout, whatever, it's all a certain amount of like self-dealing. And I think that's where it comes in. I mean, you know, because our expectations of the Democratic Party are different than what our expectations are of like a leverage buyout of whatever it is, Toys R Us or wherever it's going to be, where, you know, just to be clear, people, what happens is these leverage buyout artists come in, they use the company's money to basically finance their purchase of the company, and then they extract all sorts of cash out of it for managerial services and et cetera, et cetera. And then they're like, oh, this company's got so much debt, we should just go into bankruptcy. They're protected creditors because they're employees or they're consultants or whatever it is. And that's the same sort of dynamic that seems to be going on with this acronym on some level. It's like, I've got friends, you know, we're all sort of interconnected, and I put everybody on my board. So everybody feels comfortable that, you know, the $75 million that we raise, everybody's going to get their own piece of it in some fashion or another. And
I mean, let's just say, Sam, you were sitting right there when this was going down on a panel on MSNBC with David Plouffe, who was made a board member of Acronym, and it was entirely to validate the entire enterprise to the types of people that would be encouraged to buy in to whatever Acronym was selling. David Plouffe's presence on that board was intended to signal that this is something that you have to deal with, right? That this is an organization that you're going to have to purchase goods and services from. And we see that in the regular economy all the time. People put on boards for those reasons, for favor granting and you know, the ability to signal a certain cachet. And you were there when Chris Hayes asked the question, you know, what do you know about this thing? And he, you know, like we see with Wells Fargo and all these other places that, that have scandals, he disclaimed any responsibility for it whatsoever. He said, this isn't my thing. I was just a volunteer. I don't know anything about anything. And, you know, of course, Acronym in the aftermath said they weren't even affiliated. They were just an investor in Shadow, the app maker, when months earlier they said, hey, we're launching Shadow. They were obviously much more involved, but they were trying, you know, this sort of denial of responsibility is a major feature of this whole thing as well. And that's part of the bullshit economy, too.
I mean, what are the chances now? It's quite possible, it seems now that I've read into it, that Dave Plouffe is a volunteer on the board of director. And I think he's using that in terms of, like, he doesn't get paid to be on the board. And I think that's
right. He's an unpaid board member because his value doesn't need to be paid with cash.
Well,
I mean, it's.
There's $75 million that they control, the Acronym, as far as I can tell, right? They've been raising that. What are the chances? And what they do is they go out and then like support other organizations. What are the chances that David Plouffe does not have an organization that is not benefiting from that type
or
of support?
Or friends of David
Plouffe. Exactly.
Or people in the orbit of David Plouffe or you know, people who were involved with the Obama administration or the Obama campaign in some way. I mean, this is all a network. That's how you have to think of it. And when you place someone from the network on the board, you open up all of these possibilities for the rest of the network to, you know, get paid.
And then they all, I mean, you know, conspire is maybe too big of a word, but they all are aligned in terms of an agenda to protect when there is a failure like that. So if I had the majority report fund and I had, anonymous donors pouring money into it and I had $75 million and I give, the American Prospect $2 million as part of a grant, when I go out
you're welcome to do that, by the way. You're allowed to do that
When I start going, you know, off on an Ambien bender and start tweeting about Roman Polanski again, then you could be sure that I'm going to get a very like a puff piece in the American Prospect at that point, and one that lauds all the great tweets I've done over the years, right, David? I mean, that's the way this works, essentially. And
it's favor factories, it's back scratching, and and to segue into the other thing that I wrote about last week, this all comes from the top. This all comes from the fact that Tom Perez was placed into the leadership of the DNC in order to keep this favor train rolling. And the only way that you're going to stop something like this that obviously is producing, you know, really negative results, almost like this, when you get this kind of nepotism in where who you know matters more than the quality of the product and service, you're always going to get these problems. And until you eliminate the people at the top who are facilitating it, I don't think you're going to get to anywhere good. And that's why I call for Perez to resign.
And I think the way you've framed it is really the important thing, because from an ideological perspective, you know, Ellison was certainly different than Perez, but the issue was not, I don't think it was ever ideological for the Obama people as much as it was like, we need our guy there so that our peeps, our tribe, as it were, we'll have
That's
access
right.
to this, you know, this, these resources. And it's,
I mean,
go ahead.
It's hard to come up with another reason why that happened. You know, if you remember back in 2017, the Democratic Party had coalesced around Keith Ellison. Chuck Schumer endorsed him. Harry Reid endorsed him. This was something that was going to be seen much like Howard Dean in 2005 when he was made DNC chair after he lost an election, but he had a base of support within the party. Much like that, Ellison sort of coming into the fold was, you know, an opportunity to sort of bring together the disparate factions and at least come up with some sort of rough unity, rough consensus. There's no reason for Obama, who clearly engineered the installation of Perez, to disrupt that, if not for some sort of fear or worry that their guys wouldn't get the same special treatment if Ellison was in charge. I mean, what else? What's the other reason? What's the other rationale for this? I don't see one.
And, I think like at the time, this was something that I think people missed. People just assumed this is Obama bigfooting it because he doesn't like the ideological grounding of Ellison. But from the Democratic Party's perspective, they're thinking like, we would rather have Ellison and his idea, you know, what he represents ideologically.
Rather him inside the tent.
Inside the tent pissing out versus outside the tent pissing in. But Obama's people were not there because they were worried about Keith Ellison's politics. They were worried about who Keith Ellison would be giving the contracts to. And this is a dynamic that you could see in the context of the Republican Party, too. It's like it is not so much that they have an issue. Like, you know, none of these people like the Never Trumpers have an issue with the Republican Party's agenda. Right. I mean, it is that they are carrying out under Trump. It's that we're no longer in the pipeline to get the largesse that we were afforded before. Money, prestige, power, money.
That's right. I mean, we see where that has led us. The party is as fractured as it's been. Maybe more so than 2016, just because there aren't two polls now. There are multiple ones. The party is as incompetent as it's ever been. People trying to blame, Sanders wanted the caucuses. The Sanders faction wanted the caucuses. And they brought this, their confusing new rules brought this down upon the Iowa Democratic Party. The rules were the same. All the Sanders group wanted to do is have them show their work.
Yes.
And the fact that showing the work created such confusion and errors meant that they were always there. They were always a feature of this. And Perez agreed to keep the caucuses. He the only thing that he said is that, well, you have to increase access for people who are unavailable on caucus night. So Iowa said, okay, we'll do this virtual caucus with some technology. And DNC said, well, this isn't going to work. You can't do this. So they knew that the Iowa Democratic Party had a problem with technology vendors, right? They knew that this could be a problem and yet allowed this app for reporting results, which is so ridiculous because Iowa has 99 counties. There is no area of Iowa that is more than 30 minutes from a county seat. You can drive in the results of any election, any caucus, into the county seat within 30 minutes. You can use the ancient technology of the paper and the car. That's all you needed to get this done. There was no need to speed this up through any kind of technological solution. It was unnecessary. This is a solution to a non-existent problem. And yet not only did the DNC sign off on it, there is reporting that they encouraged it, that they discouraged the use of a phone tree, which, might have been used in the past, citing security. But, who ends up benefiting from that, right? It's the same blob. It's the same group of elites at the party consultant level who get rich off this stuff. So, for all those reasons, the way that Perez has disclaimed responsibility, just like Clough, saying, oh, well, this is Iowa's fault. This is the Iowa Democratic Party's fault. When there's also reporting that the DNC took over the tabulation process about a day after the caucuses. And only a couple days later did Perez say, oh, well, we have to do a re-canvass. Enough is enough. But they were involved in the first place. This was an attempt to distance himself, even though he was completely implicated. For all those reasons, I really think that Perez has to go. And I think it's a matter of time.
Actually. Well, I think they got to get to it quick because it's going to be relevant to have a DNC head. I mean, we just lost the heads of the convention, the 2020 convention in Milwaukee. Yeah. Like, you know, if you're headed
over a bad work environment. Like, yeah. I don't know if it was sexual harassment or what, but it was over a toxic work environment.
This is what we call poor management, folks. And just to be clear. Also, on the whole, on the new metrics, I will just walk people through this because it'll take 1 minute. The process of doing the caucus goes like this: people come in, they vote. We'll call that vote number one. Anybody who doesn't have 15% in terms of candidates, they get reassigned. There is vote number two. So if you didn't fit 15% in the first vote, you go and you throw your support against somebody else. That's vote number two. That's a number. That number gets converted into the SDEs, which is the statewide delegates. And then that number gets sent into the Iowa Democratic Party, and they do another calculation that gets statewide delegates. The only difference, the process did not change. It's just that they wrote down this time the first vote and the second vote. So that you could, like you say, see the work. And so all you needed was that same sheet of paper. You just have two other numbers on that sheet of paper, essentially.
Yeah. But look, I mean, this is a stupid system. There shouldn't have been caucuses.
I agree.
They're anti-democratic. They create, I don't think, much confusion, but obviously they create too much confusion for people running caucuses to handle. And there shouldn't be any. And the good news is that seven states converted from caucuses to primaries this year. We're not going to see this much. The problem, of course, we see it right at the top of the election cycle because Nevada is going to do one. And Iowa, two of the first three states, yep, are still using this archaic anti-democratic system. That was a mistake. Trying to solve the problem with technology just compounded a mistake on top of that.
And I'm quite convinced there's another story here. $60,000 or $70,000 doesn't seem worth the effort, frankly, of something like this. I have a feeling that this was like we're going to do a test pilot of this, you know, technology, which basically amounts to, it's a calculator that sends results. Right. Like how complicated could this have possibly been?
This is a high school project. I mean, that's what's so amazing about this. The fact that you could screw that up. And now Nevada is using what they're insisting is not an app, but a tool. Another, which is something that goes on your tablet and that you have to use to tabulate results. It's essentially the same thing. They refuse to write it down or use an adding machine or an abacus or anything. They just they're insistent. They have to use this stuff. We're going to do some reporting on this week.
Why can't they just write it down on a piece of paper?
Exact same trap.
Take a picture of that paper and email it to the people at the headquarters, essentially. But all right.
I mean, there's this serious paranoia over hacking. And you can't use phones, you can't use email, you can't use, but you can use an app that's connected to the internet. Apparently, that's not a problem.
Well, that's why I say send a photograph of the piece of paper. Like, you know, the ability to hack that seems to me to be rather difficult. People may not be able to see it, but they can't change the numbers. It's just a picture, but whatever. Maybe that's what they'll do and they just won't tell us. All right. So, with all that said,
I just want to make one more point that. This has now become part of the cultural wallpaper about the Democratic Party. Like, Bernie Sanders over the weekend was on Face the Nation, and it was asked to him. It's a ridiculous question, but it was asked to him, you know, if you guys can't run the caucus properly, how are you going to run healthcare? And that's a stupid question to ask, but you do understand it at some level because people sort of get their cues about parties from these kinds of events.
Yep.
And so this was bigger than just one, you know, misstep. It was it's threatening to define the party, a party of activist government, and that's why it's completely unforgivable.
That's right. That's right. I mean, these are not going to be the same people who are ostensibly going to be doing any of these major programs, hopefully. But
right.
Hopefully, although, you know, who knows what their intentions were. But it creates this narrative that is beyond unhelpful. All right. So with that said, we got the primaries happening in New Hampshire. Presumably this is going to be a little bit cleaner because it is just one vote. What's the number of the vote? You know, maybe
I don't know how they're going to figure it out without Matt. I mean, how do you even add numbers without Matt these days? I don't get it.
The question is,
good luck to New Hampshire.
The question is, how much money is being left on the table when someone hasn't come in and monetized this by saying that there's a problem in the way that we're doing this, right?
Exactly.
Like, and this is, I mean, that, you know, again, this dynamic of like, there's dumb money there. There's no one holding it to account. How do I get my hands on some of that? That nothing better explains the problems with the U.S. economy and just broadly speaking, our society today. I just want to touch on this.
That's it.
What? Well, but there's an interesting dynamic that's also going on. You know, Donald Trump is talking about he's got 95% support now amongst Republicans. His his numbers on the economy are probably as good as they've been. The job numbers have been revised down. So it now appears that his job growth has been annually less than in the later years of the Obama administration. In some years, not too much less, but broadly less. But the unemployment rate is as low as it's been certainly since in our lifetimes. There was a story about Berlin, New Hampshire, and which used to be like the third most prosperous city in New Hampshire, about 10,000 people. They had a paper mill there. The city has been devastated. The unemployment rate is low, but everybody, and there's supposedly, you know, jobs in the newspaper, but it's all crappy jobs. And so there's a tremendous amount of despair there. Trump almost won that city in 2016. And it's possible he could win it this time around. It used to be a Democratic style, you know, sort of. Give me your sense of like what you think is going to happen in New Hampshire and you know, how this sort of general election is going to shape up, because it's.
Right. You're asking a couple different questions. So New Hampshire, I think we have a pretty good sense of what's going to happen. Sanders looks like he's likely going to win. Buttigieg looks like he's likely going to be in second, unless the dynamic has really changed over the weekend and Klobuchar has eaten away at his vote. There is a possibility that Sanders could get even as low as 25% of the popular vote and 50% or more of the delegates, because there's this whole 15% viability threshold.
Yep.
And polling right now shows that only Sanders and Buttigieg are above that. And so if that holds, then the delegates are just awarded to those two proportionally. And that would give Sanders majority if he's in first. So there's a sense that if the field remains a little bit fractured, even on into Super Tuesday, Sanders can continue to gain a majority of delegates without getting a majority of votes. And this is an area where the delegate math sort of works in his favor, whereas in Iowa, it worked against him to a small extent. So that's one thing to look for is does anybody get – how many people get viable?
Right.
How many get over that 15% hump? So that's sort of the primary thing. And then, you know, how many people are able to go on? Is Biden able to go on if he finishes fifth in New Hampshire, which is very likely, I think, at this point? Can he get to South Carolina, which he claims to be his firewall? And what does it do to him in South Carolina if he's constantly finishing this low in the first two states? So those are some of the things to watch. As far as the general is concerned, I mean, economically, I think that because it's sort of been a similar trajectory, maybe a slightly smaller trajectory from the second term of the Obama administration, Trump gets the benefit of that just because there were already a lot of people gainfully employed, and now there are more. And he's used that, you know, to his advantage to say, look, we're at the lowest job growth, or we're at the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. Yeah, I mean, you're following the exact path of the previous administration, if not lower, at a lower acceleration. You know, this is last week, because of the Iowa mess and some other factors, was the week that, you know, the Democrats in despair narrative
right.
started to take hold about the presidential election. I think there's a long way to go. I think we certainly don't have the answer economically. And I'll just if you think you know what's going to be the state of the economy come November, I mean, I'll give you one word, and that's coronavirus, which could have a tremendous social and economic impact. I'm going to be writing about that this week. There's not enough information to really say, like, you know, he's a safe bet or he's not. I think we're, but I think what we're starting to figure out is, you know, I'd like to see some more data after Iowa. Iowa turned out to be a little bit higher than the 2016 baseline. It ended up, I think, 180,000 rather than 170,000. Which is pathetic. It's like 15% of the electorate that participates in caucuses. You know, I think we need more data. We need to see what the turnout looks like in New Hampshire, and then on Super Tuesday. But you know, there is these sort of Democrats in despair narratives tend to sort of fold in on themselves, and there's a deep correlation between the question, who do you think will win the election, and who wins the election? Whether that's a bandwagon effect or what, perception can become reality to a certain extent. And so we'll have to see how that plays out with as the primary goes on.
Do you have another 5 minutes? I know you got to go soon. Do you have another five?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. Yeah. Two things. One, a quick response on this. What do you think about the theory that there's a significant portion of Democrats who are just like, I don't care who the nominee is. I'm not going to turn out and just pick somebody so I can vote against Trump, as explaining why the numbers weren't off, you know, the chart? Because we saw young people beat 2008 significantly in Iowa.
Right.
And presumably right. they're excited to vote for Sanders for the most part, but maybe other candidates as well. And, you know, they're more engaged, and that maybe older people were just like, look, I'm going to vote for the Democrat. I don't feel like getting out of the house today. And particularly because it's a caucus. That's the first thing.
I mean, how's that align with the midterms? Like, midterm primaries, I thought were even in the primaries were pretty high turnout. And that was a situation of, I don't care who the Democrat is, as long as I can vote against a Republican.
I don't know if we saw that with midterm primaries, you know, huge numbers. But I think that's also, it could be just an easier decision, right? Like, I'm going to go and engage in this because I only know one candidate. Now, I think, like, it's just, I don't know. That's a theory. I guess we need more data on that. But here's the other thing.
Yeah.
It seems to me like Mike Bloomberg is really the biggest winner of all of this, at least in terms of, you know, to the extent that you want to think about those lanes, because he is the one guy of, whether it's, you know, Buttigieg has a lot of money. But Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Biden in particular, even if we want to throw Warren in there on some level, they're all going to have money problems getting past, you know, whatever it is, Super Tuesday. The only person who won't is Mike Bloomberg. He never has to leave the race. And it seems to me like there's just like a quiet coalescing around him in some way. And maybe coalescing is the wrong word. You know, he has a certain magnetic attraction that involves, again, money. He's just throwing money everywhere. I keep hearing stories of like people leaving the Biden campaign because they're getting, you know, 1.7x of what you would get, you know, being paid for Biden or anybody else. And that, you know, you see all these people who are getting these endorsements because they all, you know, it's like, you know, who says no to a billionaire? Because you think that like maybe if I just stand next to him, he drops $100,000 on the ground.
I think you're right. I think it's very dangerous. You know, there's a piece by Nathan Robinson in Current Affairs that said, you know, I keep hearing people around me saying they're looking at Bloomberg, and I feel like I'm in the Ionesco play, The Rhinoceros, where all of a sudden everybody around me is turning into a rhinoceros, and I don't understand why. This is, you know, as you said, the attraction of money, the power of money. And let's just say, I mean, this is not a perfect comparison and people are going to knock me for it. But, you know, I remember 4 years ago when everybody was like, well, you would never have a Trump in the Democratic Party. A Trump figure could never take over the Democratic Party. And I'm not calling Michael Bloomberg Trump. But what I'm saying is this is someone who is buying his way into politics, number one, and number two, expresses a large range of views that are diametrically opposed to the party that he is now purporting to represent. This is a guy who spoke at the 2004 Republican National Convention, defended George W. Bush, supported Scott Brown with a lot of money in his race against Warren, supported Pat Toomey with a lot of money in his races, has supported busting teachers unions all over the country, thought that we should do nothing on financial regulations after the financial crisis. This is someone with views that are completely diametrically opposed to where the Democrat Party is today. And just because he has money and a lot of people's brains have been broken by Trump, and they think, well, let's get our billionaire in there against their billionaire. This threat is real, and we will see if a Trump figure can take over the Democratic Party.
David Dayen, executive editor of the American Prospect at prospect.org. Folks, head over there. If you have not subscribed to the Prospect or checked it out in
the past year. prospect.org/subscribe, please. We can't continue to do this without reader support. That's the way of the world in media these days. You know it as well as anyone, Sam. And we really do need your support. And we had our best week of traffic in my tenure and maybe in many, many years last week during Iowa. We're doing great stuff, and we really need your support to keep going. prospect.org/subscribe.
David, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Bye. Honestly, folks, the Prospect has completely had a massive refresh under Dayen. If you've listened to this program for any period of time, you know the esteem I hold for Dayen personally. I mean, the stuff I've seen him do. In fact, he was the first guy, when I was the executive editor of the Air America website. Dorsey, do you remember this?
I do.
We had no budget, of course, because Mark Green was like, you're going to have $1 million budget, and which turned out to be, you have a dollar budget. And one of the things we did was basically took the feed from the blogs that different people wrote, and Dayen was the first guy. I was like, And you know, we paid him. I don't think it was much, but we did pay him some money. But we just basically populated the front page with his feed and, you know, stuff from the shows. But the prospect has been amazing. And, you know, they've also, like, had these situations where it's like they've done this amazing sort of full issue thing on what a president can do on day one, not with executive orders, but just – based upon the laws that exist now. And then, like, that was the day that, like, I don't know, Trump, you know, either was impeached or, you know, farted or whatever it was. And then, you know, there's been a whole host of stuff that you go back for the last, like, 3 or 4 or 5 months and read the prospect. And honestly, if you're thinking about, like, what media outlet you can support after, of course, the Majority Report, head over to the prospect because, they're doing some amazing stuff over there. And, if they had the resources to do more stuff, it would be more amazing stuff. That said, I want to remind you, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you not only are supporting the, free show, you not only get it without ads. You also get extra content every day, particularly every day that we're live. And, you know, occasionally we get bonuses that we put behind the wall. We're going to try and do more of that. Now we our chief technology officer, Kyle, has developed an in-house mechanism for us to provide members only video delivered in the feed. I'm not exactly sure how this is going to even work, but we're going to try and introduce a couple of you know, little small features that'll just hopefully you'll enjoy. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Check it out today. Also, the AM Quickie, it's exploding. It is literally exploding.
I mean, in a good way, like a firework, right. Not like a, you know, Hindenburg.
Right. It's exploding in a good way. You know, it's growing. Let's put it that way. Maybe not exploding. But AM Quickie, you can head to amquickie.com or you can access it via the app. It is about 5-6 minutes every morning. We get it out the door by 8. And it is a great way to set the table for the day. And, you know, if you have one of those days, like, I just can't listen to politics today, but I also want to make sure that I know what's going on, this is the way to do it. amquickie.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Check out Michael Brooks' show at patreon.com/TMBS. Check out the Antifada at patreon.com/TheAntifada. Jamie's up in New Hampshire now. We can have Jack call in from New Hampshire too?
I think that's the plan, yeah.
Today or tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Okay, great.
Yeah, we got a few of the greater MR universe up there.
Yeah. And also a literary hangover available at patreon.com/literary hangover. Matt's reading poems from the 17th century. Nobody else is doing it. He's like basically saving our culture. One podcast episode at a time. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.